Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thank you, Domiti. It's 9:09 on a Saturday morning. This is John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio, of course. And normally this is one more hour of Lou Manfredini's Mr. Fix-It show. If you heard Lou just before the news, you know he is taking this hour off today. It's just been an awful, terrible week for so many people in this city and in this country, and quite personally for our good friend Lou. He and Mary Beth lost a very close personal friend this week. He told me about it. And it just seemed to be too much weight for one family, for one city, and really this week for one country to have to bear again. And you heard Lou's voice crack at the end of the last hour. He said, hug those people you love and tell those people you love them every day. And I just think that is such a kind, smart, generous thing for Lou to say to the rest of us today. Do that. Hug the people you love. Hug them right now. Brenda, pick up Daisy. I'll be home in a little while. And tell the people around you that you love them every day. We should not take life for granted. It can be snuffed so preciously too quickly. Listen, I don't have a lot to say about a lot of this. We have talked a lot about it this week. The Mincing Rascals, which is a podcast we produce here at WGN Radio, is up, and we broadcast part of that podcast on Saturdays on my 10 to noon show. And so a little after 11 o'clock this morning, you'll hear the Mincing Rascals talk about some of those grave stories of the day. As Domiti's been telling you, the funeral procession for Commander Bauer runs east on Pershing Road to the Dan Ryan Expressway, then over to I-57 south. They'll exit at 111th. They'll go south on Vincennes to Monterey, west there to the cemetery. Starting at 10 o'clock this morning, the funeral, and then the procession thereafter. You're asked to wear blue today. I know you've got some in your wardrobe. If you have a blue ribbon, if you have a police or Chicago hat, today is the day to wear it. Navy Pier's Ferris wheel, its spiny arms have been lit in blue with the fallen officer badge in the center. I don't know how they're able to do that. The tops of the beautiful skyline, the buildings in downtown Chicago have been lit in blue this week as well. And today is the day to salute them and say thank you. Erin is the wife, and Grace, age 13, the daughter who we'll mourn, I guess, most Paul Bauer's passing, but we all have come to know. It's amazing to me how many people in the media knew Paul Bauer. He'd been in the force for 31 years, and he had done a lot of things, evidently, with members of the press. Rokhan spoke about him. It was just funny to me watching the TV stories, how many of them had had personal interactions with him. And as Lou said, to the person, this guy seemed to be what you'd hoped your officers around you would be.
Heard nothing but great things. I knew friends who knew him as well in the media. Nothing but great things.
And he looked the picture too, didn't he?
Yeah,
I mean, you like the cut of this man's jib. He looked like what you want your police officer to look like.
No kidding.
And acted like it too.
John, if I may really quickly add a correction, Holy Sepulchre. I pronounced the cemetery incorrectly at 111th in Austin and Alsip. And just want to remind folks again, as John just said, you can line up along that procession. They're asking folks to wear blue to show support. Again, the burial and the funeral itself is private, but that show of support will mean a lot to the family if they see you along that procession route.
On my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John on Facebook. I also, just in light of how crazy it is that too many people have guns in this country, some of them get them legally, some of them get them illegally, but we have witnessed in this country and in this city in the last 7 days just such senseless gunfire. And so everybody is saying, what are we going to do about it? There are rallies throughout the country and the city of Chicago tomorrow. And if you're Googling around, you'll find some of them. But if you've ever thought this is a day I'm going to get involved in a cause, that might be the cause for you tomorrow afternoon. Brenda and I will be at one of them, and maybe you will be too. But this is the point. On my Facebook page, I said, look, here are the members of the Illinois congressional delegation who received NRA campaign contributions in 2016. That list is not complete. The numbers aren't all that gigantic when you look at them, but that's just from the NRA. There are other gun-friendly organizations, and there are other individuals within our NRA that contribute to some of these members of the House of Representatives from Illinois and the Senate. Tammy Duckworth's name is actually on there. She got $50 from somebody as an NRA contribution, and so that appears on my Facebook page. All I said was, here's their website, here's how you can email them, here's their telephone number, and here is their NRA grade. And if you think they're doing a good job and you like the NRA support and grade that they get, call them and tell them, keep voting the way you're doing and keep doing what you're doing. And if you think that something needs to change and you want them to reconsider that alliance, then here is their phone number and here is their website, and tell them that something has to change now. I'm not telling you what to say. I'm saying if you are thinking, boy, I ought to let somebody know how I feel about this, and I think most of us are, we have put on my Facebook page the contact information for the state legislators, for the, actually, the federal legislators, the members of Congress in Illinois. We've put on my Facebook page how much they've received, how to reach them, and what their NRA grade is. And I put a little edit to that late yesterday afternoon. I actually spoke to somebody at the Federal Election Commission yesterday, and I said, how do these numbers square? And they said, well, as I mentioned just a moment ago, there's a number of different sources that can contribute to a particular candidate or a congressman or woman, but these numbers are pretty accurate. And if we need to update them or change them, we will. The amount that they've received, I don't think, is as important as their position. If you don't see somebody's name there, it is because, according to the FEC, they did not receive NRA campaign contributions. That is on my page. I'm WGN King John there. We've pinned it to the top. It's 9:15 on WGN Radio, so we'll start my usual show then, which doesn't normally sound like this, thank goodness, now, and I'll go all the way, as I do on Saturdays, until 12 noon. This would be a week that we would be talking a lot more about the new alliance that we have at WGN Radio with the Chicago White Sox. And it would also be maybe a time that I would more quickly introduce our new sports guy. Joe Brand is in the sports studio. Is it Joe Brand?
It is. Just two quick syllables.
Is that really your name? Because that sounds like, I don't know, Brand. What kind of name is that?
I'm mainly German, and the Brand comes from, my great-grandfather that was born in Germany. Actually, he fought for Germany in World War I, so I'm mainly German.
So Brand is a German name, but it makes me want to say, well, what's your brand? Sports? WGN? The White Sox brand now, right?
Hopefully, yeah.
So which is your base? Are you a lifelong Chicagoan?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Oak Lawn, went to Marist High School, went to Illinois State University.
Well, then you're a White Sox fan.
Yeah.
Or a Cubs fan.
They always have the South Side roots, so that's always
like
a part of me.
Yeah, here's what I've said about the White Sox coming to WGN Radio. We've been so busy this week. It's such a shame, at least on my show. We did take some calls about the White Sox on GN Radio during our Bright Side. Some of you were thrilled about it, but we really didn't spend a lot of time talking with you, our listeners, about that this week. I know some of you are still upset with us or the Cubs, that the Cubs aren't on WGN. I feel like we're still a Cubs station. I think we always will be, as long as the Cubs are part of Chicago. Well, that's WGN's brand. But I also think we've neglected the White Sox on this station over the years. It's been too easy to make the White Sox the punching bag. And I think that goes true not just with the White Sox, but the whole south side of the city. I think it's about time this radio station did a better job of embracing the people, the businesses, and the baseball team south of Roosevelt Road. I mean, that's part of Chicago, too. And shame on us for not having a sort of a better relationship with them and you all. I'll tell you, I've got friends who are just thrilled that the White Sox are on WGN, and then some that are like, wait a minute, what? That just doesn't seem, you've got to be kidding. That's, how am I going to get my head around that? Well, guess what? It's no longer Marshall Field either. Times
it's no longer the Sears Tower.
Blair Kamen wrote a great article this week. Was it early this week about how times change, how the John Hancock Building is no longer technically called the John Hancock Building. John Hancock offices aren't in there anymore. It's now called whatever it is on Michigan Avenue. It's got some numerical name, a generic one technically. And then somebody else, like Willis Tower, is going to have naming rights to that. So that's just the way these things go. And it's not good or bad. It is what it is, and you make the best of it. Well, that sounds like a consolation speech. I don't mean it that way at all. I hope the White Sox next year are deep in the playoffs, and wouldn't it be fun if the two teams from Chicago played each other? I do think we got ahead of this White Sox thing at the right time, by the way. I don't know, Joe, I don't know much about baseball, but the White Sox do seem as up-and-comers, right?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is one of the most intense and exciting times for White Sox fans, just because to look down the road for the upcoming years, not just this year solely, just the whole future is just so inspiring.
So you know your White Sox stuff pretty well?
Baseball is my bread and butter. It's my favorite sport.
All right, and I'm not going to call you out on this.
That's all right.
But I had members of the staff and a friend of mine named David McCauley, who is the biggest White Sox fan in the United States of America. I said, give me some fun facts, factoids, or trivia questions about the White Sox.
All right. Here we go.
Okay, Oakland boy. Griff, you can play along if you like.
Although, no, I can't.
Don't even look this way.
Well, I was just going to say, wait a minute, Joe Mattee. Where are you? Where's your parents live? What neighborhood do you? What's the address? You don't
Woodlawn.
Have to give us the address. Woodlawn. Hello.
I know. I'm a Southside fan by default, but I can't even tell you who the pitcher is. I don't know what's going on.
Well, I got news for you. They got more than one this year.
What?
I really
they can do that?
I really like their chances.
It just doesn't seem fair that you can just change them out like that.
You can't change them out like that. Next, you're going to tell them one gives the other one relief.
I had friends. It's funny how people can have blind spots about certain topics, and baseball gets to be one of them, Domati. And they were, Griff. They were really smart people. They still are. I mean, highly educated, very involved. They read the newspaper. You know, I just can't say enough about them. They know nothing about baseball so much that, and they had kids who played Little League. They thought the first baseman batted first and the second baseman.
Oh, that's fun.
When does a shortstop bat?
That's though? It. I go, well, then where do you, they go, oh, and the pitcher, where do you, so that was a lot. That was way too much calculation for them. So sorry, Steve and Carla, if you're listening, but that's you. It's 9:21. Okay, so my quiz, this is for you White Sox fans and smart people. You'll go, well, I knew that. And for the rest of us, I think we ought to know what I'm about to tell you. Lou Manfredini is taking this hour off. This is John Williams, starting a little early today. Okay, Joe Brand, our new sports guy, welcome. And Sam Panayotovich in Las Vegas, we hope and trust you are doing well. Here's some things we need to know about the White Sox. Which former White Sox player, Griffin, you can just chime in at any time, Griff, if you think you know. Which former White Sox player is being inducted into the Hall of Fame this year? Joe?
Do you want me to just say it?
Yeah.
Jim, tell me.
Yeah.
That was kind of an easy one.
You knew that one, right, Griff? Griff did not. Huh. Who was the last White Sox player to hit for 30 home runs and 100 RBI in the same season? And that's Jose Abreu for the last four seasons. You don't have to go back for that one. How many playoff? I kind of remember this. I kind of don't. I remember that when the White Sox won the World Series in 2005, they smoked it. I mean, they just breezed. The entire playoff run that year, including the World Series itself, how many games did the White Sox lose in the playoff run in 05?
One.
One is right. Name a White Sox pitcher, and by the way, they have more than one, who has thrown a perfect game.
Mark Burley.
Yeah, 2009. Humber did it in 12.
True.
And a guy named Charlie Robertson did it in 1922. The name of the White Sox mascot is Southpaw. I can't think of the name of the Cubs mascot. Is it?
You can take it, Griffin.
No, please, you. I insist.
It is Clark. It's Clark.
Oh, I guess I should have. I guess I knew that. I don't. I go to some Cubs games. I didn't know that. The name of the manager. A manager who's managed both the Cubs and the White Sox. And Rick Renteria has done both.
And John, he was also a former manager of the Kane County Cougars, which is the minor
league. Are you kidding?
Yes, yes. He was
good for him.
Manager back in 99, '93, I believe. Yeah, first guy to ever do those three teams, three Illinois professional baseball teams.
I've been told that I should be able to name three players who have played for both the Cubs and the White Sox.
David Ardsma, Sammy Sosa, and Wellington Castillo.
And Griffin, Kosuke Fukudome. Griffin has a special relationship with Kosuke Fukudome.
Why do you keep doing... I'm not asking to be a part of this.
And Ron Santo.
I have nothing to say.
And Jeff Smarja. And Giovanni
Sammy
Soto.
Sosa. And Sammy Sosa.
Jose Quintana. Kenny Lofton. The list goes on. Griff, do you know what your connection is with Kosuke Fukudome? Do you know your Kosuke Fukudome story?
I live in a city where he's played baseball.
No, it's more personal than that. I'll finish that story after the news. It's 9:28. This is WGN. I still haven't posted this quiz, but I'll just do my other favorite factoid, and I'll give you the answer on the other side of the news. The five members of baseball's 500 home run club who have worn a White Sox jersey. You'll need a number two pencil. Write this down. Five members of baseball's 500 home run club that have worn a White Sox uniform. It's not a trick question.
Are you teasing this?
After the news. By the way, Domati, thank you for that. It's 9:38. This is WGN Radio. John Williams on the air here. Normally, Lou Manfredini is until 10. Lou took this hour off. Lou will return to his normal shift, including this hour, next Saturday. And we'll keep going till 12 noon, as I normally do, Saturdays on WGN. So I've just been dropping some White Sox trivia, factoids, fun information for those of us who, now that the White Sox are coming back to WGN, I might add, Jack Brickhouse used to broadcast White Sox games on this radio station way back in the day. So we welcome them back. But now we got to kind of get back with the program, those of us who have not been big White Sox fans over these many years. So, Domati, I'm just kind of dropping stuff in. Like, you know, you can just casually now come up to somebody, based on what we told you in the last half hour, and say, well, as it turns out, the White Sox have more than one pitcher. You can use that information, Domati.
Would that be news to anyone but me?
Evidently, no, but at least you've got that in your back pocket now. And then you can say, and you know, I mean, it's all about pitching, and Philip Humber threw a perfect game in 12, and Burley did it in 09.
That's good. Now, that sounds useful.
Try that. Try that. Do it.
Did it in 09.
That's what you just heard. That's
what I heard. Did it
in 09.
I'd like to see him try to spell Mark Burley.
Really? Really, Domati, spell Burley, go.
Burley, B-U-R-L-Y.
That's exactly right. Good
there
job.
There we go.
You use that, Domati.
There we go.
Now with the correct spelling, here's Joe Brand.
B-U-E-H-R-L-E.
It looks like choose from some of these letters to spell Burley. No, that's the letters. B-U-E-H-R-L-E. Burley.
Just a big typo.
The H is silent and the E is silent.
Exactly. Okay, so before the break, I said, okay, name the five. Domati, this is going to come up later this week, so you just need this in your back pocket, my friend.
Got it.
Five members of baseball's 500 home run club have worn a White Sox uniform. I don't think this is as easy as it sounds. Joe, what have you got?
I've got Jim Thome, Frank Thomas,
yep.
Manny Ramirez,
ta-da.
Ken Griffey Jr.,
yep.
And Sammy Sosa.
Sammy Sosa. Manny Ramirez hit one playing for the White Sox. He's kind of the wild card in that bunch. I said I had a good Griffin producer Kosuke Fukudome story. It's actually an Aesop Choi story. Oops. And I don't have time for it here. It's not that great a story, so I'll skip it for now, particularly since we have a pretty good guest on the line. Speaking of sports these days, everybody's talking about the Olympics and more. A book fell onto my desk this week called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. When I watch the Olympics, some sporting events, particularly the Summer Games, I think, okay, so how fast will we ever be able to go? How far will we ever be able to jump? Mankind has now jumped over 30 feet. Get out a tape measure and marvel to the fact that somebody has gone 30 feet with one foot, just jumping, run, jump, 30 feet, land. Measure that out sometime and go, we did that? No one's ever going to go 40 feet, though. So how far could we go? And it's not just that. How long can someone hold their breath? How much pain can somebody endure? How blah, blah, blah. It's the sort of limits of human endurance that this guy Alex Hutchinson wrote about. And he joins us on WGN. Alex, it's John. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, John. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
But maybe when I think about some of these things, I think more about the summer games than the winter games. What do you have to lend to the winter games conversation?
Yeah, the winter games are a little different because everything depends on the conditions, right? So it's harder to say, is this the fastest speed skater or the fastest, you know, cross-country skier or the biggest snowboarder that we've ever seen?
Right.
But there's definitely, you know, we're talking about triple axels and things like that have never been done before. And we can kind of see, if you watch a cross-country ski race, the thing that sticks out to my mind, what you see is they'll be out there for 3 hours or something, you know, 30, 40, 50K. And just when they should be most tired, they'll start sprinting at the end of the race. And that's like one of the telltale signs that endurance is about as much about the mind as the body. Because if it was really just that their muscles were tired, they wouldn't be able to pick up and have a finishing sprint at the end of the race.
Endurance of any kind, you say?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, the way I ended up defining endurance in my book is it's the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. And that, you know, that applies in a lot of sports. It also applies when you're doing the taxes. It applies in a lot of areas of life. So I think endurance is a pretty broad concept.
Did you say that applies when you're doing your taxes?
I don't know about you. I certainly have the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. And I would also say, while writing this book, I had two kids. I have a one-year-old and a three-year-old now. And I learned a lot about endurance from that process, too. So I do think it's a very, very broad concept. Across a lot of domains, it's as much about the mind as it is about the body.
I think that's really a nice point. I think that's why I liked your book so much, because if you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning for a crying baby, or if I guess you have to do your taxes, or if you're training for a race, all of those call on endurance. And I love your definition of it. Say it one more time.
It's the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. And, you know, I'm talking about endurance. It sounds like I'm talking about life in general, but it is endurance specifically. I think it has a lot of application. And like I said, it's mental endurance is, you know, endurance. You can't talk about endurance without talking about the mind as well as the body.
Well, you tell the story in the book. Everybody has perhaps heard the story of the 4-minute barrier and how nobody could break it. Finally, somebody breaks it. And then once everybody realized it could be broken, a whole bunch of people broke it. What was the name of the guy? Lindsay? What was the name of the guy?
So John Landy was the second guy who did it. Roger Bannister did it. Everyone remembers him. John Landy kind of got the raw deal. He was only like about 6 weeks later. He ran the 4-minute mile. But the interesting thing is he had run 4:02 or better 6 times in a row. And then there's this great quote from him saying, "It's a brick wall. I'm not even going to try again. Nobody can run a 4-minute mile." Then Bannister did it. 6 weeks later, he ran 3:57.9.
So what was your version of that story?
Well, I was a track runner in college and beyond, and I was trying to break 4 minutes for the 1,500 meters, which is about 17 seconds shorter than a mile. And I was stuck. I was just like Landy. I was stuck for 4 years running 4:01 or 4:02, and I'd reached the point where I was like, okay, I know I'm very, very close to my physical limits because I've been running these times over and over again. I just want to run 3:59.9 before I, you know, walk away from the sport. And one day at this meaningless little race, the timekeeper was calling out the wrong splits during the race. So each lap, he'd call out a time, and I don't know if he started his watch at the wrong time or what happened, but he gave me the impression that I was running way faster than I'd ever run before without it feeling hard.
Right. He would say 27 seconds, but it was really 30. And as you came by and you heard 27 seconds, it was an indoor track. It's a smaller track. And you go, wow, 27 seconds. I'm really doing well.
Exactly. And when it happened again at the second lap, 57 seconds, I thought, this is the thing. You know, I'm having the day of my life. Alex, do not waste this opportunity.
But you were actually not going as fast as he was saying.
No, I was running normally. But once I had this idea in my mind, I said, this is it. Stop listening to the splits and just run like you stole something. And I ran, and I ran 3:52. So I suddenly improved by 9 seconds after 4 years of being stuck. And I found out afterwards, like, oh, you didn't run the first lap in 27 seconds. I was like, oh, Well, then, had what? Who? Where? What? But I never went back. I never again struggled to break 4 minutes. And in fact, my very next race, I improved another 3 seconds, and then another 5 seconds after that. So, just shattering that mental barrier. I mean, I know it sounds like one of these too good to be true stories, but it happened to me, and that's kind of, this was 20 years ago. That's kind of what seeded this book, this desire to understand how can that happen, and how can I bottle it and try and make it happen again.
Your book gets scientific. It talks about muscles. It talks about oxygen deprivation. It talks about all kinds of abilities to endure pain, et cetera, et cetera. But I just love this sort of mental angle, and that's the great takeaway for me, and I think for a lot of people. You also tell the story in the book about what is a feature-length story in the most recent edition of The New Yorker. That is about the guy who wanted to redo Shackleton's journey across the South Pole. You wrote your book. You were writing your book, I presume, over a year ago, right?
Yeah, this is a guy named Henry Worsley who wanted to walk solo across Antarctica, pulling his own sled, which started out weighing about 330 pounds. And you know, not to spoil the denouement, but he died after about 70 days of walking. And this happened about 2 years ago, and so maybe 3 years ago, I wrote that into my book. And it was just such an amazing story. I mean, it's a sad story, but it's an amazing tale. This guy was a really interesting guy. So I knew someone was going to dig into it soon, and I was just hoping that it didn't become old news before my book came out. So my book came out, and The New Yorker had a big feature on the guy. I'm like, that's okay. You can be what you want now, because I've told the story.
Well, and I think if you read that article, a lot of people will get this book, because it gives much broader depth and context to it.
Yeah, I said, because the reason it's so fascinating to me, like, look, it's a great adventure tale and a gripping tale on its own. But what's fascinating is that it's really, really, really rare for someone to push themselves to death. This guy, he didn't die he didn't freeze to death. He didn't run out of food. He didn't have an injury. He just really wanted to make it across Antarctica. And he kept pushing himself beyond the point where, you know, they finally airlifted him out after 70 days, and he died in hospital of massive organ failure. And this was like this rare example of someone pushing themselves to death. And what's interesting is the fact that it's so rare. You think about, look at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Look at the Olympic marathon. The second place finisher at the Olympic marathon, you know that person is pushing themselves as hard as they can. They're leaving nothing. But they cross the finish line, and they jog off and go get their sweats and, you know, drag the flag around. So, you know, it's... I wouldn't be able to push my, if I went out the door right now, I wouldn't be able to run myself unconscious. I would get tired first. So the fact that it's so rare tells us something about the nature of, the limits, the deep limits in our brain that hold us back.
Right. Yeah, the brain is and while we maybe need to respect that, we should also be reminded that we can sometimes go faster, stay up later, work harder, I don't know, do something else that would require endurance if the goal is important enough, right?
Yeah, and then these cases, sad cases like this guy Henry Worsley are very, very rare.
Yeah.
So the example that I think about is breath holding. It's like, I go 90 seconds, and that feels like I'm going to die, and that's an absolute physical limit. And I'm sure if I practiced, I could get to 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, whatever. The record for breath holding is 11 and a half minutes. With no tricks, there's no breathing oxygen beforehand. But even the guys who hold the breath for 11 minutes, they hit what's called involuntary breathing movements, these muscle contractions after about, say, 4 minutes, that it feels like a physical limit. And so that's the safety margin. So you don't want to go to 11 minutes, but you can go a little farther than you think you can. So you don't want to go all the way to the end, but
hey,
very few of us can get there anyway.
When I was at a track star at Joliet Junior College, our coach would have us run sprints holding our breath. Was that a good idea?
It's funny you should mention that, because until about like 3 days ago, I would have said, nah, that's not going to help you. But there's some new research actually just coming out in France. They've been doing it with cyclists and rugby players and swimmers, finding that, yeah, if you hold your breath for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 seconds, do a 40-yard sprint holding your breath.
That's what we would do.
You do like 20 of those,
uh-huh.
That actually kind of gives you some of the benefits that you would get from going flying to the mountains and doing an altitude training camp. And so that's I think that's actually going to be a thing in the next few years. It's just this research is totally new.
Well, it was in 1979 for the Joliet Junior College Wolves.
But, ahead of your times, you guys were.
The book is called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Nice job, Alex. Come to Chicago sometime. Let's go for a short jog, you and me, someday.
We'll push our limits to the max.
No, we will not, sir. No, we will not. We will run to Starbucks and visit. That's what I have in mind. Well done, Alex. Thanks for your time. You bet. Take care.
Thanks, John.
His book is Endure, and the last name is Hutchinson. It's 9:52. I'm John Williams. This is WGN. Thank you, Domati. This is John Williams. It's 10:10 on WGN Radio. The city is awash in blue. At night, you sure see it on the skyline. And if you are doing something today as you head out, wear some blue, maybe a blue ribbon. We all have blue jeans. I'm looking for something more pronounced than that to honor, salute, and say thank you to the men and women who serve us in the police community, and certainly as a reminder of appreciation and sorrow for Commander Paul Bauer and his family. He leaves a wife, Erin, and that lovely young girl whose picture you may have seen in the papers this week, Grace, age 13. So the funeral is underway now. The procession will take place afterwards, figure a little over an hour from now, and expect very long lines of traffic, of squad cars and people standing and saluting the route. It's in all of the papers. You've heard Domati describe it on the radio. And if you just Google Bauer route, sadly, it'll pop right up. I-57, the Dan Ryan, I don't suppose you'll be there, but maybe you'll be on 111th, Vincennes, Monterey, some of those streets in the city. I think it's actually on Halsted briefly as well. So,
that's true, yeah.
Wave, salute, and remember, and give thanks. And then let's do something to try and ensure that this sort of thing just doesn't happen again. I do not know what that is. If you want to have a conversation with your lawmaker, I've posted the names, websites, and phone numbers and NRA scores of the Illinois Congressional Delegation on my Facebook page. And if you think the direction we're going is right, call them and tell them to keep going. And if you think we need some change, then that's how you can reach out to them. We've made it very easy. The legislators who have received campaign contributions from the NRA are there, and there are their websites and phone numbers. And I'm not telling you what to tell them, but I think, as everybody's been saying, we have to have a more concrete dialogue about this other than just hopes and prayers and wishes. Those are the people you need to talk to. We've made it very easy to see what the scores are, the contributions are, the phone numbers, and how to reach out to them. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. It's 10:12 on WGN Radio. The Olympics continue as well. Does it bother you guys? By the way, Joe, you just mentioned Joe Brand, WGN Radio Sports. A guy named Sam Panionovich used to join us on Saturdays. Sam is off to Las Vegas, where he's working on Sirius Satellite Radio. You've probably heard us say goodbye to Sam over the last few weeks, but he now has a channel where he does sports betting radio, if you will. Nobody more qualified in America to do it than that young man.
No.
So, Joe, welcome to the show. Welcome to WGN. You've been with us as an intern, as a producer for years. It's good to hear you in a more pronounced role. We appreciate you helping us out on Saturdays.
Thanks. Yeah, no, obviously I'm thrilled to be here and just happy to be a part of the team.
You mentioned the standings in the Olympics. Who's in first place right now?
Norway with 22.
22.
Total medals.
Total medals. You know, I have this is funny because I printed out something. The games are obviously going on even as we speak, so the numbers change. But when I printed it out, this is what I had. Germany with 16 total medals. No, I'll do it this way. Germany with 9 golds. Then Norway with 7. The Netherlands with 6, Canada with 5, and the USA with 5. And that's the ranking. They say who's leading the Olympics? Germany is. Why? Because they've got 9 golds. But they don't have the most medals or the most points. I don't know which is the right way to score the Olympics. But if you're saying who's winning, I would say it's Norway because they have 21 medals. Again, these are a little dated, but just let me use my numbers. They had 21 medals and 43 points, 3 for gold, 2 for silver, 1 for bronze. Germany has 37, then the Netherlands 30, Canada 30, the USA is in fifth place in that case with 21, and Sweden with 18. I don't, and it doesn't bother me. Like in the summer games, I get pretty amped about it. I want to see the USA win. I hope that Lindsey Vonn does well. I was really sorry that Nathan Chen didn't do as well as we thought he was going to. But if at the end of the day they throw up the thing and they go Germany first place, I am so okay with that. I hope that doesn't make me less an American. I hope nobody wants to take away my card now. In fact, there's a little inverse thing going on. Like, you think the Netherlands, what do they got, like 50, 100 people there? And they clean up on these things. We looked it up. Per capita, it's interesting to see which nations do really well. You know, like, what's your chance of being Olympian? Well, in the United States, even though we have the best technology, there's 330 million of us, so it's still not very good. But if you go to the, if you go to Liechtenstein, where they only have 37,000 people, or Norway, where they only have 5 million, or Sweden, 9 million, you know, Hungary, 10 million, your chances are pretty good. And those are the countries that win the most per capita. Norway, Finland, Sweden, Hungary, Bahamas, Switzerland, etc. The United States is in 26th place. We have the most medals usually overall, like in the history of the Olympics, but there's just so many of us. So props to the Netherlands for pulling in over 13 medals and Norway for 21 in the Winter Games. The performance last night of Nathan Chen was, I thought, really pretty thrilling. Did you guys watch ice skating last night? Did you watch men's figure skating last night?
You know what? I didn't, but one of my friends is calling those events. He's a broadcaster, a play-by-play guy with me in the league. I'm with the Kane County Cougars. He's with a team called the Great Lakes Loons. And yeah, he got picked up by NBC, and he's out in Bristol. And
doing NBC radio?
No, television. he's in a studio.
What's his name?
His name is Chris Vosters.
All right, if I see him, I'll know the story. So he's what events is he doing?
I'm pretty sure just men's. Well, no, pair figure skating.
Really?
Yeah, it's him and his color commentator, and they're in a studio and they're watching the games. And yeah, I mean, he picked it up. He you know, started cramming all this figure skating information for the last couple of months, and yeah, he's doing it.
Chen goes from 17th. place to fifth place on the strength of six quads, five of which he completed cleanly. Japan's, is it Yuzuru Hanya? Hanyu has now in consecutive Olympics won the gold in men's figure skating. Lindsey Vonn finished tied for sixth in the women's Super G. Afterwards, she said, well, at least it wasn't fourth. Tell that to Lindsay Jacobellis. Jacobellis, easily the most dominant female athlete in the sport of snowboard cross, took the early lead in the finals and was then passed at the bottom of the hill. She finished in fourth. I believe it was 2/100ths of a second off of the podium. What a tough story that is. That, and by the way, there's a couple of events that are just awesome. And that cross, I think, is about as crazy as it gets. That's where six snowboarders go down the track, and they give them sticks, and they just whack each other, and the last person standing gets to have the trophy. It's the most fun, thrilling, heartbreaking thing, because you can be really good, and then someone will just come up and knock you down, and they go, oh, sorry, yeah, I guess you're not in the Olympics anymore. That's the way it goes. It's crazy. Michaela Schifrin did not medal either. NBC promoted Chen and Schifrin a lot in these games, and now they don't have that storyline to tell. And frankly, I wish that they would let these things play out more organically. Let the star performances come to us rather than push their stories before these people perform. Seems to be almost more pressure on them, and it feels like bait and switch for the viewers. So now you got to say, okay, here's Adam Rippon. And Adam Rippon steps up, and dang, that dude could skate. I mean, he was talking the talk. I don't know if you're a fan of Adam Rippon, but he was, you know, very emotional, very expressive, very much, I'm here for the Olympics, and the Olympics are here for me. That's my impersonation of Adam Rippon. But then you can say, okay, dude, when you get out there, you better skate well. And he skated really well. His performance was positively beautiful. He finished in 10th. And then there's this guy, Vincent Zhu, the American who gets lost in all of this. It was Chen in fifth, Zhu in sixth, and Ripon in 10th. Don't know what that was. By the way, Griffin, I said that we would have more fun White Sox factoids.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what that is. Is that coming? Whose studio is that coming from?
That was me. I apologize.
What the hell's going on in there, Joe Brand?
I'm looking at some Blackhawks sound, and you know,
what are you working?
It's still getting accustomed to everything here. I got fat fingers. I'm pressing everything
you
right now.
You can't be working.
Did you want some White Sox factoids?
Okay. Well, I've been peppering you guys with fun things we need to know. This Hall of Fame pitcher notched his 300th win in a White Sox uniform. Joe Brand, who is it?
Tom Seaver.
Tom Seaver. Pitched for the White Sox. You didn't know that.
84 through 86 with the little help from maybe you down there.
What else? The years that the Cubs and the White Sox have won the World Series. Each team's won it three times.
1917 for the White Sox. Also yep. 1906, yep, which they beat the Cubs. And then
05. So 06, 17, and 05. And then the Cubs are 07, 08, and 16. Boy, think about that in Chicago. Between the South Side and the North Side, the World Series is won in 06, 07, 08. 19, obviously. I know that's not news to a lot of you, but we're just kind of looking back at the White Sox and forward as well. And by the way, fun fact to sort of pepper in now in your passing conversations with people. Oh, yeah, I know the White Sox. They're on GN Radio. And then you say, you know that Mark Burley, spelled B-U-E-R-H-L-E, Domiti.
Switch the H and the R.
Did I get it wrong?
B-U-E-H-R.
Are you sure about that?
I'm almost sure.
B-U-E-H-R. Boy, that really does look like a typo. Burley, when he pitched that complete game at home against Seattle in April of 05, 99 minutes. 99-minute game. A 99-minute game.
That's a broadcaster's dream.
And then, I know. Frankly, it's kind of a fan's dream. Like, yeah. If I had my choice between a 99-minute game and a three-hour game, I don't know. Maybe the class is mixed on this. I think I would take a game closer to 2 hours than one closer to 3 hours. 99, you almost feel like you should get some of your money back. But 3 hours is too long for me most days. Okay, you've got a couple of other fun facts for us?
Yeah, they're not too sports-focused. One of them's more entertainment value, but I'll start off with a more sports one. I don't know if you know, but do you know where the first All-Star game was held?
It was... Well, I'm going to guess Comiskey Park.
Yeah, I was.
Who knew that?
Do you know what year?
1927.
A little higher, 33.
33.
Do you know who hit the first home run at that All-Star game?
Babe Ruth.
Yeah, that was an easy guess, but yes. Babe Ruth. And one last one. So you know how Cubs fans take a lot of pride about the Ferris Bueller's Day Off scene when they're at Wrigley, him and Cameron?
Sure.
That scene was actually supposed to be filmed at Comiskey, but the team was on the road.
Wow. I love that fact because it feels so right to have him at, he wouldn't go to the South Side.
You never know.
Ferris is a North Sider. That's funny. It's 10:22. Incidentally, speaking of Wrigley Field and the Vines, I don't know what you made of the official portrait of President Obama and Michelle Obama. But there is Barack Obama stuck into the vines at Wrigley Field, it looks like. This week I had a chance to talk to the art critic at New York Magazine, who's a Chicagoan who used to listen to WGN Radio and loves this station. And what he said about the Obama portraits I thought was just so interesting. I'll give you just a few highlights from that in a minute on GN. I don't have time to play back the whole conversation. You can find it if you go to WGNradio.com. On the John Williams page, there's my full podcast of my conversation with Jerry Saltz. He is the art critic at New York Magazine. After this week, we got our first look at President and First Lady Michelle Obama's portraits. We called him, though, to give us his sort of assessment of these portraits. What did you think? And I asked Jerry to start by describing for us the former president's portrait.
The portrait of President Obama is the president seated in a very plain wooden chair, and he's surrounded, almost enveloped, almost engulfed by a really rich bower of flowers. it's not a typical portrait at all. Usually you have presidents standing sort of proudly or gazing at their books in a library or holding an important device that is associated with them. This is just Obama looking at us, seated, almost at our level. The flowers around him are kind of interesting. They're African blue lilies, jasmine, chrysanthemums, and these sort of map Obama's journey from Kenyan roots to Hawaii to the official flower of Chicago, the chrysanthemum.
How does he look? What does his face say? I mean, I presume the expression is kind of critical. What do you see there?
He's troubled, human, a sort of rock of Gibraltar. You can feel that strange, mysterious human presence around him, a certain melancholy or a brooding or something reconciling, not just knowing. He's kindled with a kind of fiery curiosity, something that's very inner. But really, you have a picture of an ordinary man in an extraordinary situation. And this actually is the kind of metaphysical metaphor of what Obama was.
Great art critics talk like that. Jerry Saltz reviewed it in New York Magazine and talked to us this week. Our full 12-minute conversation is at WGNradio.com on the John Williams page. I'm going to play just a little more of what he said after the news in the next half hour, especially since what he said about Michelle Obama and the woman that painted Michelle Obama is spectacular. We'll do the news first, though. That's next on WGN. Thank you, Domitia. It's 10:39. The funeral service for Commander Bauer continues. Afterwards, the procession, which will stall traffic on the Dan Ryan, on Route 57, on I-57, as well as various city streets as it makes its way over to the interment on the south side. I expect that many, many people will be lining the route. If you are able to be one of them, thank you for that. And we should all today wear blue to salute, honor, and remember the men and women that serve us every day. Certainly, Commander Bauer was among them. What a sad day this is for Chicago. And I guess that's all you can do right now. The service continues, and the parade, the procession will be later this afternoon. Well, actually, I say later this afternoon. Actually, it might be late this morning. Once the service is over and then some remarks to the media there, it'll begin, so we don't have an exact hard start time on that, as I understand, right, Domitia?
Yeah, that is correct. So we see a window from 11:15 all the way to 12:45 p.m. Through which there's time set aside for remarks for some of the dignitaries to the media. So that procession could be any time between that window.
Mincing Rascals is a podcast we record at WGN Radio on Thursdays. We broadcast part of that on our Saturday morning show, and we will a little after 11 o'clock. The Mincing Rascals have a few things to say about all of this, and you might, too, a little later on in the show. Right now, I'm looking at some of the details about the movie that was made of a book that I very much enjoyed. The movie is called 12 Strong, and it's based on the New York Times bestseller Horse Soldiers. Lou Manfredini, in fact, went and saw it, and he said, wow, now that is a movie. 12 Strong, the declassified true story of the Horse Soldiers. They spent, or the author, Doug Stanton, spent 5 years on the road meeting with the actual officers. Remember, after 9/11 takes place, what are we going to do? We are going to war. We are going to fight terror wherever those people are. And so while we are mounting up an army that some members of the military brass said we need 60,000 soldiers on the ground, but Donald Rumsfeld knows, well, if we do that, we will not be responding as quickly as we need to respond. We need to do something right now. So what are we going to do? They dispatch some special forces, and they end up riding into battle on horses. This is the sort of thing that you would not believe was true, except Doug Stanton told it and told it so well. I love this book, and I started to read it again this week because the movie recently came out. You may have seen it. Doug joins us on WGN Radio. Hi, Doug. It's John Williams. Welcome back to WGN. How are you?
Good morning, John. Just great.
Congratulations, both on the book, on the movie. I don't know where your head is after something like this. Are you like, okay, good, I'm glad that's over with, or are you amped back up again? What are you thinking?
Well, here's the thing. You're kind of right. Where is our head at? The book 12 Strong, which is the movie tie-in edition of my original book, Horse Soldiers, is number one on the New York Times list for 7 weeks in a row, which is really surprising. I mean, every author wants to have people read their books, but here's what I think's happened that maybe we hadn't predicted. If you were five when 9/11 happened, you know, it's really not even history. It's kind of a memory. It's a national memory for you. And so I think a lot of people are coming to the movie and the book to figure out just how we ended up where we are today in Afghanistan, because ultimately the book's about our Pearl Harbor of the 21st century.
Yeah, no kidding. And I described exactly how these guys were dispatched and why. Why were they suddenly thrust into this thing with maybe not the sort of preparation you would normally go into battle with, but we wanted to do something right away, and we knew we might be in a prolonged war, but we weren't ready for one, at least not in Afghanistan, right?
No, there was no plan in the Pentagon in that September of 2001. It was empty about how you might move into Afghanistan. The book, you know, the horse soldiers, as I named them, that name's kind of now stuck in a national way, had never been chosen to go into a country as a lead element, ever. You know, they really, for those of us listening, think of them more as a World War II kind of OSS officer that you see about in a movie. They go in behind enemy lines, they work with locals, and in this case, they're trying to overthrow the Taliban, who at that time owned about 90% of the country. So they're really outnumbered. They're not out-equipped, because what they bring with them are these radios and laser designators that can use to target bombs on Taliban armor and steel. And they're on horses because the Afghans, and this is their fight, have been fighting the Taliban for a number of years before 9/11. And we simply join them. And they do achieve their victory. They have a very simple, clear objective of capturing this northern town. And they do that in record time. And then the world goes on, and we're still in Afghanistan today.
So the objective was obviously not to win the war, but literally to capture a specific town, and this is how they did that, right?
Right. On its face, it sounds kind of very simple, but what's interesting about the movie and what the movie captures very well is that these are small teams of men, 12 in a team, who have social, religious, and cultural and linguistic awareness of their allies, the different tribes in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban. Their job is to go in and work alongside them. And they're doing it on horseback because that's how these guys are fighting. And it was a very clear objective. I think the president told them, make the country unsafe for al-Qaeda elements in particular, and the Taliban, because that's where bin Laden and that's where al-Qaeda had been training, and Afghanistan had become an incubator, in part, as well as parts of Europe, for the 9/11 attacks. So they did it. I was talking to an intel officer not too long ago, and it shouldn't be lost on us when you go to the movie that you're watching a movie about something that really did work in American history, and it worked in a very specific way. And it's a different kind of war movie because of that.
What do you mean by that?
Well, any other filmmaker besides Molly Smith at Black Label and Bruckheimer and the screenwriters could have just simply said, here's Doug's book. But on the other hand, we're going to turn it into the Marines assaulting, landing in Afghanistan and charging through the countryside, arresting and blowing up things. The movie is a much different take on guys who are trained to be diplomats and warriors.
Yeah,
you see Chris Hemsworth and Naveed Negibon, who's fantastic, kind of huddled in the dirt with a stick, trying to work out really what's U.S. foreign policy. at the same time they're dropping bombs and riding horses and charging across the field. So
that's the part that the New York Times called catnip, I believe, for those of you that want that in your movie. You also have to appreciate, though, as I recall from the book, I haven't seen the movie yet, to be honest with you, but you've got to love the technology that came to bear and how that impressed the Allied soldiers that they were fighting with. They went, oh, wow, this is amazing, right?
Oh, absolutely. That was the changer right there. So what we didn't know back then is that they'd been fighting each other, the Taliban, these guys on horses, back and forth. So just for a moment, I'll set the scene in 10 seconds. We're charged across the plain. We're part of an Afghan tribe, a clan, an identity, and we're firing over our horses' heads at the Taliban, who are emplaced on a hillside. They're firing back at us with cannon fire and other Soviet-era stuff they've captured. And we take the hill because we swarm them. I mean, it's like an old-fashioned cavalry charge. However, the other armor will come back in reserve and counterattack and blow us off the hill. We have to retreat back up into the mountains, which is why we have the horses. What these guys, the horse soldiers, brought in, and you see in the movie, is very strategic use of bombs, literally to drop on that counterattack so they couldn't retake the hill. And that's how they move so quickly. And we could have in 2003 or even late 2002, you know, said we've declared victory and gone home, because the Taliban, in many ways, was really collapsed or had disappeared back into the countryside.
You know, when this all happened, we were all paying intense attention to the news. But I don't remember hearing the story of the horse soldiers until you wrote about it. Were they kept secret? Were we not told who they were, what they did, how they did it?
We really weren't told. I'd written a book about World War II called In Harm's Way about the USS Indianapolis, and which Chicago has been very friendly to. And on kind of the profile of that book, I was able to just basically go to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, walk around the team rooms and knock on doors and try to find guys who'd been there, because I'd seen in the background of photographs and video footage coming out later these fuzzy Americans with beards. And I said, why are these guys wearing beards? Why aren't they wearing helmets? Who are they? Because in some ways, one of their roles is to blend in with the locals. And I thought that was a really interesting way to approach warfare.
No kidding. The movie is 12 Strong, the declassified true story of horse soldiers, based on your bestseller. And if you have not read it yet, you yet should. It's called Horse Soldiers, and it's Doug Stanton's term. Doug, it's nice to talk to you again. What are you working on now, by the way? When am I going to interview you again?
Well, thank you. I just published a book about Vietnam called The Odyssey of Echo Company. And actually, I met the protagonist of that nonfiction book in Afghanistan in Kabul when I was on a helicopter, and thus began the long journey of writing the story of one recon platoon. And you know, if we're still in Afghanistan and not really thinking about it, we're certainly not in Vietnam anymore. But I do think America is really ready. You know, if you ask any guy if you do it a poll on the air about all 70-year-olds listening, I think a lot of them would call in and say, I'm thinking about Vietnam, but I don't know how to talk about it. And so that book was meant to be that opening invitation.
Ask Ken Burns. What's the name of this book?
The Odyssey of Echo Company. And it actually features a young man who is 19 from Gary, Indiana, who joined up.
All right. That's our next conversation. I'll let you go this time. We'll visit again soon.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Doug Stanton. It's 10:50, and this is WGN. Commander Bauer's funeral continues. The procession later on. We'll keep you posted as we continue to watch and learn about that today here on WGN. A little while ago, we played for you part of an interview that I was able to do earlier this week with Jerry Saltz, the art critic for The New Yorker, for New York Magazine. And we were describing, or he was for us, the Obama portraits, which were revealed this week. And there was a couple of things that he said about Michelle Obama's portrait and the artist that I thought were especially interesting.
I recognized her instantly. And if you put this painting anywhere, I'd go, hey, you're painting Michelle Obama. And I also think it makes her an everyday queen. An everyday queen, meaning she's one of us. That's what she said at the unveiling, that these paintings would have a real effect on girls and girls of color who would look at these paintings and see people that looked like them rather than only white faces, which is what Western art history has been for 1,000 years.
You know, my observation about this, too, as you speak and as I look at them, is that while they are both colorful pictures, hers is in a light blue background and, like you said, almost grayed. Obama's, the president's face, is much more colorful. It looks more like a portrait or a photograph, and it's against a bright green. They go together, though. I mean, to me, there's no mistaking the fact that these two people are kindred spirits. Their expressions are somewhat similar.
I think that's really good observation. Both of them also are alone. There's really nothing around them. Obama's placed in nature. Michelle Obama is taken and put in a sort of limbo, no place. And that is, again, a metaphor for where they were. They were part of everything and yet always separated out. You want a portrait that looks like every other presidential portrait? Go ahead, do one. I do want to point out something about Amy Sherald, the painter, the young woman who made Michelle's painting.
Mm-hmm.
She is recently discovered. She only emerged, she's about 43. She emerged 2 years ago in a group show in Washington, D.C. Her work, luckily, was selected out of thousands of others. And she had been working as a waitress, living in Baltimore, had a heart transplant in her 30s, and that was going to be it. And then out of nowhere, it's a lot like the Obama story. Michelle Obama is the great-great-granddaughter of slaves. Out of nowhere, the American story happens.
Thank you for your time.
Call anytime. Like I said, I grew up listening to WGN. You are my home station.
Well, welcome back, Jerry. We'll be in touch.
Congratulations on a good job. You're all doing great.
That's Jerry Saltz saying that earlier this week. Before he knew, we got the White Sox. It's coming up on 10:58. Thank you, Domati. So lots of sports on WGN Radio. I see that one of the commanders is speaking still at the funeral for Commander Paul Bauer. That is still going on. We will keep you posted on traffic and the news of the procession, which should take place in this hour here in Chicago. Domati's been giving you the route. We've been talking about it. And if you don't know it, just look for a bunch of people wearing blue, and that should be the parade route. You can Google it as well. And if you are not wearing blue today or are getting dressed soon and planning on what to take out, today would be the good day to honor the men and women that serve us in the police force by wearing blue, a blue ribbon, something like that would be appropriate today. Later today, 1 o'clock, I just want to make sure I got this right, Mr. Brand, we've got a 1 o'clock Northwestern Michigan State.
That is correct.
You know, listen, if Wisconsin can beat Purdue, I would have given you $1,000 on that game. No way Purdue is beating Wisconsin. Wisconsin wins. Did you see that one coming? I'll bet you did not.
No, I didn't. And like I said, we were talking a little bit in between on Frank Kaminsky number retirement day. So, I mean, there was just a whole bunch of energy in the arena. I think I saw a tweet that, you know, the players wanted to prove something to Kaminsky that day. And boy, did they.
Boy, did they step up. So you got Northwestern against a very good Michigan State team this afternoon. And then at 7:30 tonight, the Blackhawks, or whoever's wearing those uniforms these days, take to the ice. That's just been so disappointing this season. Or at least, I mean, this is the same team that opened the season scoring 10 goals against the defending Stanley Cup champs. We should just run that game. Let's just start playing that game on the radio.
It's just totally out of character, and I really think that that's maybe a reason why they're having such a difficult time of stopping this skid, is because they've never been this team. They've always been the dominant one.
Hopefully that team comes back next year.
Hopefully.
11:12 on WGN Radio. Just real quick, this is a note from the editorial in the Chicago Sun-Times. Nicholas Cruz, age 19, bought his gun legally. Imagine that. We live in a country where a young man can walk into a store or go online and buy an AR-15. Shamari Leggett, on the other hand, came by his gun illegally. That's a safe assumption. Even in the United States, a convicted armed robber can't buy a gun legally. Leggett's gun was fitted with an extended magazine that can hold 30 bullets. Cruz and Leggett, that is to say, were decked out to kill. So on Wednesday in Parkland, Florida, Cruz allegedly killed 17 people. And on Tuesday in Chicago, Leggett allegedly killed a police officer, Commander Paul Bauer. There is no way in hell, the Sun-Times wrote, either man should have had access to such guns. Our nation's gun laws are stupid. And then they wrote this: the number of guns held in civilian hands in the United States is about 310 million. About half of all the civilian-owned guns in the world are in the hands of people in the United States. Americans are 10 times more likely to be killed by guns, legally obtained or not, than people in other developed countries, studies show. In Germany, for example, the chances of being killed by a gun are about the same as being killed in the United States by a falling object. It's 11:13 now, and so that's where we begin with our Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio, this time with Eric Zorn, columnist from the Chicago Tribune, Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist, and Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio News, who says,
we've been doing this a long time, and this week has been, I don't know if I'm getting older or what's happening, but it was much more impactful. I mean, I think there is a profound sadness to think of a commander who is not in a position to do what he did and to pursue a guy just because he heard a radio call and lost his life in an instant like that is profoundly sad. And then to look at what's happening in this school, you know, the thing about what happened in this school is that this was a young man apparently who was on the radar, but he didn't go far enough for them to take him off the street or anything like that, and it's just a haunting situation.
There have been stories lately in the news about school shootings that have been arrested in advance, right? They've found kids who are planning things and they stop them. So there is more vigilance, but I mean, at a certain point, all the vigilance in the world is not going to stop someone with that kind of weapon who wants to just charge through a school like that.
You had a guy saying yesterday in the hours afterwards, a student saying, you know, we used to joke that he was going to come back and shoot people, and now he did. I think we all know people in our lives who we assign that to or worry about that sometime. But what do you do about that? You can't look into the future and arrest someone as a preemptive strike.
I'm frankly really angry about this. Obviously, what we're doing doesn't work. Thoughts and prayers are wonderful things.
They're not wonderful things in this case because they're a dodge.
I disagree completely. But that's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is this: in my comic strip Prickly City, I had the temerity to say, "Can we at least talk about gun control?" Didn't advocate anything, and my commenters at Go Comics went bananas. And just, no, we can't, you want to take my guns away, you want the government, blah, blah, blah. Can you say, how did this guy get guns?
There are sources today saying that he purchased it legally.
I mean, how did he get his hands on these guns?
What do you mean, how could you ask that question? It's legal to buy them.
Not if you have mental health issues, if the background checks actually work.
No, I'm not, does he have documented mental health issues?
Well,
can I go back?
Go ahead.
Because I'm all for thoughts and prayers. I don't want to be misunderstood. I am sick and tired of people the day after a tragedy offering their thoughts and prayers and not another thing. You know, in that way, it is a dodge. When you stand there and you say, my thoughts and prayers are with these people, and you do nothing else.
Thoughts and prayers are the air guitar of solutions.
Yeah,
right. Well, I don't think they're meant to be solutions in many instances. I think if you lose a father or a mother and someone says, our thoughts and prayers are with you, is that, well, screw you, you're not helping me.
No, I'm talking about the guys. I'm talking about the politicians who go on TV and say that, and then they don't do anything
else.
Okay,
the ones who are in a position,
hollow.
Like the Mark Rubios down in Florida, who have, you know, thought and prayer every single time.
Right.
The fact is, there's an every single time now, and this is becoming a thing.
Yeah, so maybe you ought to stop thinking and praying about it and start doing something about it.
You can do both.
Well, you can do both, fine. All right, but I'm with Steve on this. Thoughts and prayers, to me, are beyond feckless. It's a dodge, and I want them to do something. So, you know, I think in all of our minds, we've got this little checklist of things we can do, like, all right, make it hard for people with mental illness to get a gun, or put schools on lockdown, or arm the students and arm the teachers, and all of these things that I think we would all agree just won't solve the problem. Literally, how do you, for instance, flag people that you think might be a danger to others? How do you do that? And what do you do about them? I mean, can you imagine if we, and maybe we'll go there, but just imagine the pushback there's going to be when somebody says, I think Scott Stantis is just unstable and we should deny him his Second Amendment right. Good luck to you on that. Now, here's one thing, though, that I think is a box we haven't seriously tried to check. Limit the sale of some of these weapons. Just limit the sale. And maybe that won't work, and then we'll uncheck that box. But why are we so afraid to give it a try? I don't know. 8 million AR-15s in this.
Did anyone think, okay, after Sandy Hook, which arguably is worse than this. I mean, as horrible as this is, Sandy Hook, these kids were younger, and it was just horrible. Nothing happened. After Las Vegas, where nearly three times as many people were killed, nothing happened. They couldn't even ban bump stocks.
I was going to say that the thoughts and prayers crowd on Capitol Hill couldn't even ban bump stocks when almost every one of them agreed it should be done. And they can't even do that.
I'm actually okay with people owning handguns for self-defense, owning rifles for hunting, and so on. But I think that there should be limits on this. And every time you propose that, as Scott says, the gun rights people go crazy. And they vote. And they let their legislators know. I mean, maybe one of the solutions is for people who are on the other side of this issue, maybe they make it more apparent to politicians that they're going to cast their vote. One of the people in our meeting this morning said, I'm never going to cast a vote for anyone who's got a good rating from the NRA again. Never will.
But another way to look at that is that the negative wins. You're voting against someone for something. I'm voting against someone who's pro-life. That's what that carries the day. I'm voting against someone who is pro-gun control.
It doesn't have to be so absolutist anyway. I mean, this is my plea to the NRA and to the gun people.
The NRA was in favor of getting rid of the bump stocks.
For about a week.
Give up a point. Just once lose a battle. Just once say, you know what, this is important to us, but we know it's important to you, so we'll go ahead and concede this point. Just imagine the good that would do to the debate overall.
Yeah, but it's slippery slope, and that's going to be the argument for everybody on everything.
But it is a slippery slope, and the slope we've slipped down is that everyone has an automatic weapon. I mean, they've always argued NRA against anything because of a slippery slope, and so we really have gone down that slippery slope on the other side.
Touché, Steve Bertrand. It's 11:20 on WGN. That's Steve Bertrand, Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist for the Tribune, and Eric Zorn, the Chicago Tribune columnist. The gang had some interesting things to say about the gubernatorial race, too. We'll pick it up there in just a minute. 11:23 WGN. This is John Williams. I'm just watching the monitors here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue, and looks like the Commander Bauer service is still ongoing. Afterwards, the funeral procession will keep you posted, and maybe if you see something coming or going by, feel free to call us at 312-981-7200. I mentioned a moment ago the editorial in the Chicago Sun-Times about how easy it is for people to legally and illegally get guns in the case of Commander Bauer's shooting and the shooting in Florida at the high school. There is a rally tomorrow at 1 o'clock. From 1 to 3 tomorrow, the rally will be held at the Federal Plaza. That's on South Dearborn, downtown Chicago. Followed by the march from Federal Plaza to Daley Plaza, then to the River Walk across Trump Tower. There's a parade route if you go online. They're expecting several thousand people tomorrow. It's a consortium of groups that are trying to change gun laws in this country. And if that's something you want to be part of, it's at 1 o'clock tomorrow, downtown Chicago. One more note about the Mincing Rascals. This is a podcast we do weekly here. If you just, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, type in The Mincing Rascals. You'll find some of us here at WGN and at the Chicago Tribune. So this week, the guys were also talking a little bit about the gubernatorial race. Scott Stantis was talking about the Republican side. That goes in part like this. Griff?
I haven't seen any tracking polls for the Republican race for the last couple of weeks, but Jeannie Ives had that ad that offended a lot of people, and rightfully so. And then, I have to believe that it got her a pretty good bump downstate because now she's doing commercials and begins her speeches. Well, now do I have your attention?
Yeah.
You know,
It's because,
you know, with a wink. And I just think that actually makes it all uglier. It's though I did something that we all know is vile. But hey, it's okay now that I've got your attention. That commercial should stop right there.
Donald Trump is suing her for copyright infringement. That's how he got all the traction.
She has a line in the National Review. The National Review calls Governor Bruce Rauner the worst Republican governor in the country. Because he is. And that's a great line.
That's a good line.
Yeah,
and he is. He's awful, and that's why I predicted months ago that Ives would be a factor, and she definitely is going to be. The fact that she's now got two other big money people from the conservative side dumping a lot of money into her campaign. I'm talking about.
Eric, if you're a Democrat, do you pick up a Republican ballot and vote for Ives?
No, I don't think you do because you have a choice to make in the Democratic primary. And if you're a Democrat in Cook County, you have a choice to make also in the Cook County assessor's race.
Steve, your point is that if you are a Democrat, you vote for Ives to make it
Rauner
easier.
Would probably be the stronger general election candidate.
For Ives,
but if you play it forward, that's the whole, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because that'll show him. You know, and then he becomes president.
You got Donald Trump.
Right.
I know. Jeannie Ives could be the governor of Illinois if you're not careful. I wanted to talk just briefly, guys, about this convoluted story. There is a young woman. Her name is Elena Hampton, and she worked in Marty Quinn's office. Actually, Kevin Quinn was her direct supervisor. He is the brother of Alderman Marty Quinn. This Quinn guy, Kevin, was constantly text messaging back and forth with her. He is her direct supervisor. And he is saying things like, I'll just read from some of them. Hey, do you have any idea what I'm going to say? She texts back, I really don't. He says, you are smoking hot. She says, LOL, thank you. He texts, can I ask you a question? Sure. Do you have a boyfriend? I don't. I'm surprised. That's a compliment. Later, I forgot to ask, how did the canvass go for Marwick this past weekend? No response. Later, hey, I'm not sure if you got my note about Marwick and your campaigning. So he's always kind of opening the door with business, but he is constantly texting her over the course of several months about how pretty she is. And later he says, okay, so you don't want to mix work with pleasure. What if we didn't know each other? And I was standing, and this is after she's told him to go away, and I was standing next to you at a Starbucks, and it's just unrelenting. Eric, one of your colleagues at the Tribune tweeted this week, reading these exchanges are exhausting.
She definitely says no, and I've read the tweets as well.
Here's my question. Oh, yeah, she does. And she's so professional about it, even though her letter to Mike Madigan was handwritten on lined notebook paper, but I just thought it would be electronically delivered. But
he doesn't have an email.
Mike Madigan does not?
No.
Does not do email.
Doesn't do email, doesn't do Facebook, doesn't do anything.
Thank you. That
you can trace things.
How about that? Is this implicate Mike Madigan in any way? And what should the result be of that sort of constant pursuit of affection?
I'll take that, John. I think it does implicate Madigan because he knew about it in November and nothing happened until February, whatever it was.
Well, they say that maybe she asked them to be circumspect about this. And so maybe their idea of being circumspect was doing nothing about it.
Certainly circumspect.
Had the activity stopped? Because I thought I read somewhere where the brother went to him and said, quit it. And he quit, yes. Okay, so.
So what should the result be then?
Whatever the result should be, it should be quick, I think. I mean, I think you can't say, you can't wait 3 months to do it. And you might say, well, you know what? Yeah, he asked her out too many times, but she said no, and he stopped. And that's it. You might say that. Or you might say, we can't have something like someone like this in an organization. But you can't wait around until to see what the blowback is.
You're in a position of authority, and all of this has transpired. Do you fire Quinn?
Yeah, I think I let him go.
I do, too. I mean, I think that's pretty easy.
In this moment,
in this day and age, I mean, fair, but it is what it is.
Take the day and age out of it. Because the day and age implies...
20 years ago, you didn't, but today you absolutely do.
That's true. So let's go back 4 years.
Okay.
No, really, let's not go back to Mad Men. Let's go back 3 or 4 years. And in this day and age, there's so much extra weight that comes with all these. There's political pressure, social pressure. So go before that.
Back then, I think managers would have been advised to manage it rather than fire the person. Hillary Clinton did as much when she had something like that on her own campaign.
That wasn't the way she handled that was not cool.
I don't think it was. So I'm sorry, Steve. I know what you're asking me to do, and I can't do it.
Right.
All I'm saying is today he needs to be fired, and they all need to be embarrassed. And I don't know what it does to Madigan.
I think it reflects poorly on him. And frankly, I think that if the Democratic Party were smart, they would realize that Mike Madigan has really become a millstone around their neck. Now, it's independent of judgment whether he's been effective in manipulating the legislature and hanging on to the majority there. He is going to be tied around the neck of just about every Democratic candidate in this state, and there is a and the campaign, no matter what you can say about Bruce Rauner, and I've said a lot of bad things, the one thing that he has succeeded at is he has succeeded in driving Mike Madigan's approval numbers down.
Yeah.
Mike Madigan is I get letters from people all the time like it's Mike Madigan, everything is Mike Madigan's fault. Everything bad that's happened is Mike Madigan's fault. That is a common thought.
That's Eric Zorn, Steve Bertrand, Scott Stannis, I'm John Williams, Krista McQuarrie. Patty Vasquez often join us for the Mincing Rascals, too. Wherever you listen to your finer podcast, do share that one. Comment on our page, too, and listen to the Mincing Rascals. It's 11:31 on WGN. The guys talked about more than just that. You can hear more of it there. We'll hear the news with Doma T. Pongo next on WGN.